the 18th, and this is an interview with Lieutenant General Lane, with Dr. Irish Roy and Mr. Chris Main. Okay, Reg.
Okay.
Away we go.
Yep. Well, in March of 42, I had done three operations as captain. My first three operations as captain, one to Paris, to that Renault Works, and then Essen, and then Cologne. And then, towards the end of March, we were, as a squadron, detailed to go up to Kinloss, which, of course, way up in northern Scotland. And we had no idea what it was all about. And we went up, the whole squadron, I say the whole squadron, no, we had sent about more than that, 12 crews. About 12 crews went up on the 27th of March. And it was, of course, we hadn't been there very long before we had our first briefing, and the operation was to go, was to Trondheim up in Norway, and the target was the Tirpitz. Now, I mentioned earlier how the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau caused and were giving the Admiralty heart failure. Well, of course, the Tirpitz up in Norway was more than heart failure. If he'd ever come out, they would have really been upset. But the idea was that Bomber Command was targeted to try and damage the Tirpitz, if not sink her, and stop her from getting out into the Atlantic. Well, I think there were only two squadrons on the attack. We were at Kinloss, and there was another squadron at another base nearby up in Scotland. And the reason for Scotland, of course, is that a trip from England to Trondheim was a long, long haul, and we had to get as close to the target as we possibly could for range purposes.
Can I ask you a question here? Did you have any special training with respect to accurate bombing?
Negative. No, nothing. The only thing that was special about this raid was that on the first, on this raid, the actual raid came off on the 30th because we had to wait for weather forecasts and so forth. We were carrying a special incendiary, and I can't for the life of me remember why. It must have been some special chemical that would have had some effect on the ship, reaction with metal, and perhaps to keep anti-aircraft fire under control. I don't know. But I remember they were not the long, normal 4-pound incendiary. These were more like 5-gallon tins, the paint tin, the square paint tin, and they were all also set into the containers. I can't remember how many were in a container, but I suppose there would probably be 8 or 10 in a container on each bomb rack. And we were never, I'm going to digress just for a second here. Whenever any special stores were carried, we were never told what they did or who designed them or anything about them. All we were told was how to drop them. And I suppose there were security aspects of the thing. So the less the crews knew, the better. So that if they were shot down, they could honestly say, I don't know what had happened. So it was not uncommon not to know what was in it. And all we commented on was the unusual shape of these incendiary bombs. They were just, as I say, there was no aerodynamic shape to them. They were literally tin cans, and that was the size of it. And we never were told. Well, the raid finally got off on the 30th, and it was a long haul. That whole trip there and back was eight and a half hours, and that's a long haul in Halifax. And when we got over Norway, much to our chagrin, there was a layer of cloud, quite low cloud. So that it really was a question of where the hell were we? And again, with no nav aids and nothing but astro to work on, there were no visual pinpoints or anything like that. And we got over what we thought should have been the Trondheim Fjord. Oh, I should also add that Trondheim Fjord itself is quite a large fjord. And the Tirpitz was up Trondheim Fjord in another very tiny fjord, anchored right against the wall of that particular fjord, with quite high mountains on either side. I use the word mountains because they were very high. They were very high. But they were steep sides to the fjord. And the one that the tiny fjord that the Tirpitz was in, it couldn't have been very wide. I'm talking in terms of, say, perhaps 400 yards wide. It was that narrow. It was a very, very narrow fjord. And there was a bit of a valley up off the end, the end of the fjord itself. And that was, our approach had to be, of course, up the fjord and then in. We were briefed to go in at very low level. We were briefed to go in at masthead height. And I can't remember what the masts on the surface were, but for the thing, our party about 125 feet, so we were told to go in at 200 feet. For the purposes of accuracy in the bombing, but these stores, which had no, as I say, they had no aerodynamics, and it was a question, they had to be dropped and they tumbled. And they didn't want to tumble too far, otherwise they'd go spread like crazy. Well, when we arrived on our estimated time of arrival, we were still overcrowded. Then there was a damn break in the cloud, quite a large hole. And I could see, that there was a chance to go down. So I had decided that I would let down through this hole in the cloud. And by let down, I mean just go in a constant circle, because I knew we were in the mountainous area. And I had to make sure that I could get back up again. If I got in the cloud, we were in trouble. So the answer was to let down visual and continue to let down visually. But if we run into any cloud, or if they, all of a sudden I could went visual and could see any that we were low, much lower than I had anticipated, then of course we'd go back up again. It was a bit risky. But again, this, as I say, was about my fourth trip as a captain, so I was still pretty naive about this whole thing and pressed on regardless. Well, we let down through this hole, and we got down below cloud, and golly, we barely could see the outline of a fjord, so we knew we were probably in Trondheim Fjord. So we decided that we would have a crack at going after the turpids if we could just get at one pinpoint. Well, while I was circling over this water, all of a sudden everything opened up, and of course we were right on. Our navigation had been perfect. We were right over Trondheim. Our Trondheim was on the shoreline, and we were circling just off Trondheim. And by this time, we were down to about 1,500 to 1,000 feet. Well, and we were all by ourselves. Golly, the searchlights came up, and they even had guns up on the side of the fjord, so that they were shooting down at you as well as shooting up at you. And I remember I decided that the best thing to do was to follow the track that had been given to us as the target run. So I headed in that direction, because no doubt where we were. We've got our pinpoint, all right. We were over Trondheim because of the defenses. And I had Sergeant Hammond, another Canadian who joined the squadron by this time. He was my second pilot. Again, the procedure of standing up beside the pilot, the captain. And the ATCAC actually was bouncing off the water in front of us. And it was funny. He ducked down, and then he'd come up, and he just put his eyes up look out the window, so he could see all this terrible stuff going on. Then he ducked down again, and he popped up and down like a yo-yo about five times. And it was so humorous, as a matter of fact, that I broke out laughing. I think it must have been more hysterical laughter than anything else. But it was funny as hell to watch this character popping up and down every time he saw, put his head up and saw all of the scene, all this bloody flak all over the place.
You could see the guns, could you?
Oh, hell, well, you could see where they were coming from, because they were using tracers.
Yeah.
Well, the crazy thing was that finally, on our route, and then it was pitch black. And, of course, I knew that there was no hope of picking up, because under this layer of cloud, there was no hope of picking up a pinpoint. So I just opened up everything. This is all taking place in the matter of what? Perhaps a minute. Minute 90 seconds, something like that. I just pulled the nose up and opened everything up and went up into the clouds, because obviously we weren't going to get near that. At least I had no idea where the actual run into the tiny fjord was. Mm-hmm. And if I kept going on the course I was without knowing exactly where I was, we were going to plow into the hills. And secondly, it was damn dangerous where we were. So the best thing to do was get in the clouds. So we pulled up, and we had all these damn stores, so we had to get rid of them, and I can remember. It was a moonlight night, of course. The raid had been laid on for a moonlight night. And then when we got above cloud, and of course he'd marched lots of snow, and there was a great big snowfield. It was one of the most beautiful sights in this clear moon, and we flew over it, and I knew what to say, so I just opened up the bomb doors, and we dumped all these incendiaries way up in the bloody mountains on our way out. Well, when we got back to base, there was great disappointment. Because we were the only ones that had gotten down. We were the only ones that found that hole in the cloud and got down below. And we were the only ones that had been shot at. Everyone else had missed the target either through inaccuracies in navigation or had realized that there was no hope and was
more experience than I had, and the right thing had gone back home.
Well, when you say we, do you mean, is this a single plane, or...
Oh, no, just, yes, one plane. Yeah. Just my airplane.
Right.
Just myself. No one else had had a crack at it. And so it was not a... it was quite an unsuccessful raid. Well, we then went back to base at Linton. And thinking that, well, that was that. But by God, the next month, as soon as the full moon came along, we were back up again. And in the meantime, we had not been given any other raids. I suppose Bomber Command and Admiralty had decided that this, there had to be a real crack at this, and that we would do nothing else until we went up there. Well, we went up on the 23rd of April, the second time, and then on the 27th, the raid was laid on again. Now, this time, though, instead of carrying incendiaries, we were carrying special mines. And they were just like round, big round balls, just like the mines, smaller than the mines that would be put in for sea mining, but they were nevertheless round. And the principle here was, again, to go in at low level, masthead, and try and drop these mines so that they would roll, if they didn't actually fall in the water between the ship and the shore, or the side of the fjord, at least with the steepness, that they might roll down the side of the fjord, and the idea being that they would sink and go off between the hull and the side of the fjord. And with the ship being right up against it, obviously the pressure would be enormous. And I don't remember how many we had. It weren't that many, because the run was so short. The length of the ship was basically your bombing run, and then you had to get them down, and they were dropped off very quickly. It was a very rapid salvo. But even so, at the speed we were going, I think we only had about four bombs on board. They were fairly big ones, but...
Now, this time, it's clear.
Well, this time, this was what we were briefed on. And so this time, when we took off, and again, full moon, and this time we got over the target, and it was clear. And the idea was to let down off of Trondheim, and then head up Trondheim Fjord to a tiny little island that was just off the entrance to the fjord where the Tirpitz was. And then to do a timed run. And we're now talking about a timed run of a matter of, say, 10 or 15 seconds. And it was that kind of a timed run. It was that short a distance. The idea was to be down to your altitude at the island and then go right in. Mm-hmm. Well, when we came over, of course, there's no trouble picking up Trondheim Fjord and all the other Trondheim and all those. And, of course, this time we stayed far enough away from Trondheim so that we escaped the defenses of the actual port itself. And then started our letdown, started our bombing run. Oh, I should also add nothing. Don McIntyre, the other Canadian who'd done the conversions onto Halifax at the same time I had, we decided this time, it was such a lovely night, that we'd fly up in formation, just fly up in company. So we did. A very loose formation, but nevertheless close together, because it was such a bright night you could see for miles. And Don said, all right, when we get to the target, I'll go in first. And I said, okay, if you want to, go ahead. So when he got into Trondheim Fjord, he went just ahead of me. And by that, I mean I could see him just ahead of me. In other words, we were line astern, but I was probably, perhaps as much as a quarter of a mile behind him. So on the bombing, on the run, we let down. Well, down, if the Germans, of course, hadn't arranged all kinds of smoke generators in the fjord itself, so that by the time they had warning that we were there, they started all these smoke generators, and there was no wind, so the fjord itself very rapidly filled, the tiny fjord where the Tirpitz was, very rapidly filled with smoke, so that you couldn't see the actual Tirpitz. And this was where this timed run was so important, that it meant, so that if this had happened, someone must have assumed that there might be smoke generators to as camouflage, that a timed run would do it. Well, Don went in, and golly, as soon as we got near this tiny little island, which was just the Montefiore, the Tirpitz was well defended. They had guns all over the bloody place, all light action. They were on both sides of the on the narrow fjord. They were at shoreline. They seemed to be on the top of the bloody mountain. The Tirpitz was putting up quite a little display herself, just literally fanning it up. It was like going into a hailstorm. Well, I watched Don go in ahead of me, and Don got clobbered. He really did. I watched him smoking like hell, and then I had to stop worrying about him because I was in trouble myself. because we were being clobbered. We were bloody 20-millimeter shells seemed to be hitting the airplane all over the goddamn place. And we were still on our bomb run. We still hadn't dropped our bomb. And I could hear the 20-millimeters hitting the aircraft, and I was just waiting for us to explode because it would just take one in one of the fuel tanks, and the way we'd go, we'd just blow up. In the meantime, everything was happening so fast. It really does, and we're moving very quite quickly, and things happen so fast. But, of course, when those 20-millimeter shells are coming at you at a rate of about, 1,000 a minute, you don't have to have many hit you before you know that things are happening. No time to worry about whether we had any injuries. We were still flying, and so my bomb aimer, again, who was Bill Sykes, very cool lad, we went in, and we did the timed run, and we knew that we were in the fjord, of course, and we knew roughly where the trip was, and we just dropped our mines. And then I just literally pulled up. I knew that if I went ahead, I'd be perhaps in trouble. And the easiest way to escape, because they were still shooting like crazy at us, the easiest escape seemed to be to pull up and just slide over the hill beside the turpets. And if I could just get up high enough and slide over the hill and get over the other side, then I would be away from all the ACAC. And that's what I did. After our bombs had gone, I just pulled up. And now, by this time, we were losing one of our engines. One of the shells had hit and knocked out one of the engines, and the coolant actually was gone. So it had to be feathered. So we were now all busy with an engine that was in trouble. And I was checking with the crew, had anybody hurt? And for just incredible, no one had been injured. So I thanked for that and said, well, now what we've got to do is get home. Well, we got home. In my airplane, the most serious damage to my airplane, and it must have happened as I was making one of my turns, a turn into the run onto the target, because of all the shells that hit me, the most serious one was one that had hit one of my hit underneath my wing, but it had hit the main spar. And the main spar on the Halifax is probably about 9 inches to 10 inches wide, and it hit right in the middle of the main spar. And that one shell, and it was a 20-mil shell, it just cracked that main spar and almost shattered the main spar. But if it had been a few inches either side, it would have been into a fuel tank. And if it had been into a fuel tank, then that, of course, would have been it. The shells that hit the fuselage, and we had several in the fuselage, just blew great big holes in the side of the fuselage, and that was where I was amazed that no one had been injured. Well, we got back to base on three engines, and, of course, the squadron had taken a clobbering, and we lost four crews that night. And the Admiralty decided that there would be a third raid, immediately, the next night.
At this point, do you know whether or not you've hit the plane?
No idea. Yeah. No idea whether the ship had been hit or not. But the Admiralty, because of the weather, they decided that, because of the smoke, they decided there should be a third raid. Well, I went to the squadron commander, and I said, well, I was quite willing to fly my plane, in the condition it was, with the holes in it and so forth, but I didn't realize how badly damaged the main spar was. And the engineers took one look at the airplane and said, no way. You'd only need to get into some very bad rough weather or perhaps throw that airplane around too much, and that whole wing was like a fold on you. And that we had no spare airplanes up there. So I was not allowed to go on the third raid, which was a repeat of the previous night. And we lost another four crews out of the squadron on that. So where we had started where we had taken 12 crews up, we came back to base with four crews, which was a pretty bad decimation of the squadron. And I was one. And if I had gone on that third raid, who knows, probably I wouldn't have made it either. But there were two... One of the squadron commander from one of the other squadrons was DCT Bennett, who was then a wing commander. And DCT Bennett was shot down. He managed to escape and get into Sweden, and then was flown back to England, and became the air officer commanding of Pathfinders later on in the war. He was a great navigation king. He'd been with British Airways before the war. He'd written books on navigation and engineering and wireless as well. He was a very capable and qualified man in the airfield. Commander of Pathfinders later on. Now, the other thing was that we'd been back about, I suppose it would be about 4 weeks later, 6 weeks later, when we'd returned to base. And, of course, the squadron morale was pretty low because we'd taken such a shellacking.
when who walks into the bloody mess but Don McIntyre, who I had seen, as far as I was concerned, go up in smoke ahead of me on the bombing run in over the Tirpitz. And I thought I was seeing a ghost when he came in, because no way could anyone escape from that airplane the way she was on fire. And as I say, I never did see it wind up, because I was too damn busy looking after my own problems when I had written it off, and I reported him as shot down and no survivors when I reported back. And Don was one of the four crews that went for a chop on that second raid. Well, of course, his story was truly quite incredible. He was hit very badly. They had fire. The airplane was on fire, all right. And the cockpit filled with smoke, and it was so bad that all he could do, that he couldn't see. He couldn't see out of the airplane, and here we were at low level in mountains and so forth. So he ripped the escape hatch off over his head, and he sort of let go of his safety harness, and then he stood on the seat with his hands on the control column here, and with his head sticking out the top so he could see where the hell he was. And of course, in the slipstream, and no goggles, fantastic. Well, he realized that he had to do something, because he was going to. The chances of them blowing up were very, very good. They had enough fire that they were lucky to have gotten as far as they did. So he decided that the best thing they could do was crash. May as well get it over with before they blew up, and take a chance on the crash. So he just chopped all power, just brought everything off, and let his airspeed fall right back as far as, so that he was just above the stall, and then began to let down and fall down. Well, by God, if they didn't land on a frozen lake, and the airplane, the lake was wide enough that they came to a stop about 25 feet from the cliff on the other end of this lake. Still on fire, still burning, and they all got out of the airplane, except that the tail gunner had, somehow or other, he broke his ankle, either getting out of the airplane or in the crash. Never was confirmed. Well, they got to the shore, and they sat there, and they watched their airplane burn out and then sink through the... It burned hard enough that it burned through the ice, and the ice up there must have been pretty thick at that time of the year, but it burned through and went through, and that was it. Well, they then had a council of war. What the hell could they do? Here they were with about 4 or 5 feet of snow all over the place. They were in mountains. They knew where they knew where Sweden was. What to do? Well, Don was a real gung-ho type, and he said, "We're going to walk to Sweden." And regardless of the bloody winter conditions, they were going to walk to Sweden. So they had a council of war, decided they couldn't take the tail gunner. He was too badly injured, and it would be just too awkward to carry him all the way to Sweden. So they left him and said, "Good luck." And they set off. Well, they hadn't gone very far before... they got through that first night, and they got through the next day, hadn't seen anybody, and it was then that Don's navigator, who was a very slight person, I don't suppose his navigator weighed more than perhaps about 145 pounds soaking wet, and he was quite a slight boy, he collapsed. He literally just couldn't take it anymore. He was in just physical fatigue. He just wasn't sturdy enough for that kind of thing, and Don himself was a good, hard, sturdy character. So Don said, "Okay, I'll carry you." So Don actually carried that lad. They went through all the next day, and this is through heavy snow, heavy, heavy snow, taking turns breaking trail. No snowshoes or anything like that, just wading through heavy snow. And, of course, getting very discouraged, not knowing whether they should find the next farmhouse and go in and give themselves up. But Don was a great one. As I say, he was a real gung-ho type, and he kept encouraging them and saying, "Over the next hill. I'm sure the border's over the next hill," knowing full well that it wasn't. And they were using the escape and evasion map. There was a pouch for Norway, and that's the only map they had, was the escape and evasion map. Well, because everything burned up in the airplane, they didn't have time to get the charts out of the airplane or like that. Everything just went up in smoke. And finally they went through, they had to rest finally, and they just literally collapsed. They found some kind of shelter in the trees, and that was it. They managed to sleep there, get some rest, and then they had to start off again. And they got through the next night,
When Don, by this time they were all, they hadn't been eating, they only had the rations they had in their pockets, their emergency rations, they hadn't eaten anything. Of course, fatigue was enormous, and the emotion, the shock of what they'd been through was really beginning to get to them, even though they were thankful they were alive. And they came up to one hill, and they looked over the hill, and then down below was a farm. And it was a first really good civilization that they had seen. It was obviously a big place, and that meant that there were other farms around. And then so they had a council of war. Again, should they go in and get food and ask for assistance, seek for assistance, because they now were blisters. You can imagine the shape they were in. They were blisters, and Don himself now was beginning to show the fatigue of having to carry that navigator with some help from the other troops. But he was the one who was primarily doing the packing. Well, again, a council of war, and Don prevailed. He said, no, I'm sure that over that next hill is the border. Now, let's get up there, and if we get a pinpoint and we know it's not the border, we'll come back, and we'll go into and ask for help there. Well, they pressed on, and God, if over the next hill there was the border. So they went in, of course, and crossed the border, and then were picked up by the Swedish border patrols, and were just, that was it. They gave themselves up. And they found out, as they were being interrogated right there on the border, they found out that the farm that they had passed was the leading quisling for that whole district. And if they had gone in there, of course, they would have been over in a matter of seconds, as far as they were concerned. They would not have received any assistance at all. So they were very thankful. Well, there was an arrangement between Sweden and Great Britain during the war, and it may have been the same arrangement with Germany, I don't know. But the mosquito had just beginning to come on the scene. No one knew about the mosquito at that stage, but they had a few of them. They had been built. And these damn mosquitoes were being used to ferry people like aircrew back and forth between Sweden and England. And what was very simple, you were strapped into the bomb bay of the airplane with an oxygen tank, and that was it. And you were there until you got out the other end. And if you didn't freeze to death, you were okay. If you froze to death, too bloody bad. And Don McIntyre and Bennett came back the same way, too. DCT Bennett, the other wing commander who had been shot down. Don came back. No ill effects. They had kept him, thrown him into hospital, and they'd had been reported that he was okay, but I had not picked up the report in front of him. And when he walked in that mess, as I say, I thought I was seeing a damn apparition. But that basically was his story. And this talk about intestinal fortitude and stamina, the way he kept that whole crew. Now, they all survived, and they all got back to England, ultimately. The tail gunner, unfortunately, was picked up by the Norwegians, he was a POW. He was, I don't know what ever happened, but he did not come back. He was a POW. But it was a great effort on Don's part, and...
did he get a gong for that?
No, he did not. He got a gong later. Don was a very reticent type. It was, actually, I didn't get the story until I saw him, not right immediately there. Oh, he went over it very casually. But he glossed over it. He didn't go into the details. And it wasn't until much later when he'd gone out, having been shot down in Europe, he was not allowed to fly over Europe again. So he went out to the Middle East and was flying out of the Middle East. And it wasn't until I saw him much later that he finally sat down and I said, come on now, Don, let's hear the story of that one. And then he told the whole story. And he never told the intelligence people the whole story. It was a great, great, great shame, because you're right, he should have, there are two or three he should have had for the effort that he did on that damn thing. Incredible story. Such incredible. And one other thing that I found out later, he was mad as hell because at Bennett, because his story, according to him, was that Bennett, same sort of thing, Bennett crashed. And the crew, somehow or other, were not too badly injured or were okay. And Bennett lit off on his own and left his crew to be captured. And they were all captured. And Bennett was the only one to get across the border into Sweden. So Don was some irate that Bennett would have done that. I can't vouch the story, but Don was the one who checked into it, because he saw Bennett, of course, in Sweden. Yeah. They were together there.
Oh, I see.
When it was time to come back. Because once they'd gone through the interrogation,
they were not kept in prison or anything like that. They were on sort of on your officer's honor type of
right.
thing, and wait until there was nowhere for them to go anyway. I mean, hell, they were safe in Sweden in a neutral country,
yeah.
and an opportunity to get back to England. So there was no need to incarcerate them. They were fine.
Yeah, bless my soul.
But the effort of Don and his crew, I think, is really a staggering story. And I've asked Don a couple of times if he would write it, but he just won't. He is still with General Electric in Toronto. He survived the war. He did survive the war. He went out to the Middle East and then came back home. And after the war, he had been a teacher before the war, then joined GE, and is now one of the executives of GE in Toronto. We write to each other every once in a while just to keep in touch.
Yeah,
but he's a fine person too. Well, that is typical of a man.
Yeah.
The kind of man he was, and probably still is.
What about the trip itself?
Well, we then had no word. The photo planes went out, but there was no way of knowing whether we had done any damage. And every time any plane came near the place, they start up these smoke generators, so that and they were pretty effective smoke generators. They worked very quickly. And an airplane coming in over the coast would be picked up, and warning would go out, and so it was a sheer time factor. Wasn't it about that time also that they started to put those mini subs in on the Tirpitz?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they did hit,
mm-hmm.
and the mini subs I think did some damage to the
yep.
Tirpitz.
Yep.
So it was more likely, and probably the greater odds are that it was the mini-subs who did the damage rather than either of those
mm-hmm.
last bombing attacks. There may have been some superficial damage done with those mines going off. There may have been a lucky one.
Mm-hmm.
But my guess is that little or no damage was done to the Tirpitz on those two raids. That they cost of a hell of a lot of crews.
Well, two-thirds of
the army. Oh, yes, and the other squadron was very badly hit, too. Because the point being that on those second and third, the last two raids, in brilliant full moon, bright moonlight, snow all over the place. So, of course, it was just like being in a shooting barrel from the side of those mountains. Hell, they could hardly miss a plane coming in. They had lots of guns, and they were shooting now. No way could planes get through that, and many of them survived. And of course, they didn't. Well, that was my fifth operation, and that was a longer trip. That was nearly 9 hours. That one, so that was a long time.
It was a long year.
A long, long time. Well, then settled down to what I would just call routine bombing operations from there on, through my first tour of operations with 35 Squadron. Lots of raids. A tour, by the way, is 30 trips.
Yeah.
So I had done five as a second pilot. And by the time of my last squadron raid, I had now a total of 10 trips.
Mm-hmm.
So I was becoming a relatively experienced bomber pilot with a few more raids under my belt. And in June of 42, I was due for my automatic promotion to flying officer. The good book said 1 year as a pilot officer, and then you became a flying officer. Well, before I even got my substantive flying officer, I had been promoted to acting flight lieutenant. So I was made an acting flight lieutenant early in June. So I had been arrived in the squadron in November, so sort of what, about 6 or 7 months later, I was promoted to flight lieutenant, an acting rank.
Now, does this mean, incidentally, that you would have the same responsibility, but just an increase in rank?
Just an increase in rank, yes. You became sort of a senior captain. That's really what a flight lieutenant meant, an acting rank. You were now getting to be an experienced captain. You'd been around long enough to get promoted. That's really what it boiled down to.
Yeah.
You weren't a flight commander, but you were a senior, and you began to take on the odd responsibility in the flight if the flight commander wanted something to do, or if he was away on leave. One of the flight attendants became the acting flight commander, or you'd take on any special jobs and so forth.
Well, weren't you promoted full time in July of that
year?
Not full time, but not acting, but
yes, that's right. That came along, yes, because by that time I had become flying officer, and then after flying officer, there was no time gap. It was merely a matter of, it wasn't, I suppose, the easiest way to describe it would be merit. And, of course, in those days, survival. Up to flight lieutenant. Substandard flight lieutenant. And then from there on, it was acting. I don't know why. There was a wartime policy from only issuing acting ranks. I suppose they were always frightened that they gave substandard ranks. What the hell would they do when the war ended?
Yeah.
So it was acting ranks from there on. With the exception of those who had been in the pre-war Air Force and who might have survived and would be remained on, and they might have gotten some standard ranks as they went down the rank. But most of it was acting. Well, it went on, and in looking at that in that first tour, I noticed that there, again, the Battle of the Atlantic was obviously having an effect. For example, in June the 20th, we went to Emden. June the 22nd, we went to Emden. June the 25th, we went to Bremen. June the 29th, we went to Bremen. And, of course, most of these attacks were against submarine yards and pens and shipbuilding and that sort of thing. So it was, July the 2nd, Bremen, again. 19th, Vegesack. All of these were ports. So it was Bomber Command, Bomber Command being used to support the Battle of the Atlantic. And, again, in 42, things were pretty serious in the Atlantic. But primarily, the Ruhr was it seemed to be a milkrun. We used to refer to it as a milkrun because it was coming up so often. Ruhr. Now the defenses were constantly improving during this time period, and the casualties, the losses, began to creep up. And now talking about the normal raid, not those special operations like the daylight on Brest or the Tirpitz, but just the normal routine operation. Defenses were improving. I don't know exactly when the Germans developed their radar, but certainly predicting of the heavy ACAC was becoming much more accurate. Night fighters were not really still on the scene, although the Germans were beginning to think about it, but it was ACAC that was causing the trouble. And we still had quite a number of people who insisted on going in low. Now, an example. My first captain was Sergeant Williams. And I heard later that when he'd finished his tour and then had gone on to instructing and then had come back to do a second tour, and went for a chop almost on his first trip because he developed the theory that if you came back on the deck, you were safe. And on his first trip, they went drop right down out of the target, and they passed over a defended area, were picked up by a couple of searchlights, and, of course, a light ACAC got them, and they were shot down at about 500 feet. Things changed in that time period that he'd been away. They hadn't realized, and I don't suppose any of us who were constantly in operations appreciated the improvements that were taking place in the German defenses, because we were reacting ourselves to each change as it appeared on the scene. For those who had been away, had done a tour in the early days, and then been off, say, for a year, and then come back for a second tour, there was a significant change. And having survived their first tour, I suppose they sort of felt that they were the cat's meow. They knew all, they had all the answers, but they didn't, because it was a new ball game.
Yeah.
And it went like that all during the war. It was getting progressively tougher and tougher and tougher.
Well, now, if I can interrupt for a minute, Reg, in this period, you're in the summer,
fall of
42.
Right.
By this time, the Americans would be coming over.
The Americans were all down south.
Oh, I see.
So we never saw the Americans. The only time you saw Americans was if you did get some leave and you went down to London. Yeah. London was a long way from York. The trains were infrequent. The trains were packed.
Yeah.
And if you did go, it meant standing up the whole way. Your chances of getting a room were practically nil. So London was that place you really didn't go. You only went to London if... I only went to London. I think I only went to London once during that whole time because I had relatives in London. I had never met Narsim. So I went down and I stayed with them for about a week. But the Americans were not there. We didn't have anything to do with them and didn't associate ourselves with them in any way. And there was only one other raid in that first tour that I might refer to. In July the 30th, we did an operation on Saarbrücken. And I can remember it was not a... We let down along with everybody else. The winds had changed. dropped a few flares, saw what we assumed to be Saarbrücken, and everybody was bombing it. No defenses at all, none. And it was, again, flying at about 2,000 feet up and down. We just flew up and down, dropped our bombs one at a time. It was like being on a practice range. Their target was the railway junction, and there was some industry along the side. Well, it was a great foo-fah the next day, because we hadn't hit Saarbrücken at all. We'd hit a tiny Saarbrücken, I think it was, a tiny bloody little place about 10 miles away from Saarbrücken, and we blasted it, knocked it. No wonder there were no defenses. Yeah. It was a marshalling yard, but it was a small one, nothing like Saarbrücken. So there was a great to-do on that one, because it was a hell of a mess, but it was all on the wrong target. And I suppose we should have known, should have realized, that as there were no defenses, that obviously we weren't... Saarbrücken was a defended target, and therefore we should have...
Well, you have mentioned several times doing something like the question. You said that you dropped the flares and then you go in and bomb.
Yeah. Well,
now, this to me assumes that you go over, drop a flare, and then come back.
That's right, you do.
Around.
And you make, then you do a visual sighting on... The flares would burn for about a minute and a half to 2 minutes. So in that time, you had to go over the target, drop your flare, then make your turn, come around, and get back far enough so that your bomb aimer, in the light of the flare, could see the target, pick up the aiming point, and you hoped get you onto a bombing run immediately.
Yeah.
If he didn't, then what you did was, you were on the first run, you identified the target, you sort of made sure you were there. Then you went around the second time, dropped another flare, but this time came around and cut it a little finer, but with a knowing the course you wanted to take in on the target, the heading, compass heading, lining up on that so that right away quick, so that the bomb aimer then would only have to give you some relatively minor directions at the last minute to bring you in on the aiming point. What happened in several of these cases, such as that one in Saarbrücken, the marching yards looked, I suppose it was a question of marshalling yards looking so much like any other marshalling yard, and it was a sheer question of finger trouble, as we used to say, just bad target identification. But the crazy thing was that everyone else did it. It was incredible that, and again, I don't know how many airplanes were on that raid, but there were a lot, that they all went to that one target. And I think the reason for that probably is that the earlier people on the target had misread the target, the aiming point, and had gone to this small town, dropped the bombs. And then a crew coming in, when bombing is going on a given spot, a crew coming in has to make a big decision. If a navigator says that is not the target, then who is right and who is wrong? You see an awful lot of bombing going on.
Yeah.
And the captain has to make a decision. Are they all wrong and my navigator right, or is my navigator making a mistake and they're all right? Well, the odds are, of course, that your navigator is wrong and they're all right. So what happened in most cases was that the captain would then say, all right, we will bomb where the bombs are going down, regardless of what navigator. And once you started that, then you just added to that confusion for the people coming behind. And as the raid mounted, many, many navigators cursed and swore because they were sure they were right, and the captain having overriding them and saying, no, we're going to bomb over there, and the navigator saying, you're not bombing the right target, but too bad, too late. This is right. This is where that was where the idea of developing or getting a better system of the target identification, and not only target identification, but concentration of bombs on the aiming point. The creep back that I mentioned, I have already mentioned.
Yeah.
Try to avoid that, and by having someone control the raid, so there would be no creep back. Well, that was it. And the 35 Squadron, I had finished my first tour of operations, had done my 30 trips, and I had been transferred to an operational training unit. And by this time, there were so many Halifaxes coming on the scene that they'd done away with squadron conversion, which is what I had gone through. And they had now set up, actually, what they called heavy conversion units. And I had been transferred to one, and I didn't want to go. And so the thought of doing instructing and didn't thrill me at all. And at that very time, the Bombing Command decided to form Pathfinders.
And as it happened, the squadron to come from four group. Oh, I should perhaps preface that by saying that there were four groups: 1, 3, 5, and 4. 1, 3, 4, 5 were the heavy bomber groups. Two group was a light bomber group. 1, 3, 4, 5. Each group was to provide a squadron as their contribution to the formation of the Pathfinder group.
Mm-hmm.
So when Pathfinders formed, there were four squadrons, four heavy squadrons, and 35 squadron was selected to be the squadron to leave from four group to go down south to where Pathfinders were to be brought together. So I went to, also at that time, a new squadron commander had come in, and lo and behold, if it wasn't this lad, Jimmy Marks, who was the man when I first arrived at Abingdon, when I went home to Whitley's, when I first arrived in England, walked in the mess, seeing this good-looking, tall Englishman wearing the DSO and the DFC. Well, that was Jimmy Marks, who was then a squadron leader. And lo and behold, if he hadn't arrived on the squadron, and there was the squadron commander. Just a magnificent man. God, I don't think he'd been on the squadron a month before he knew every ground crew by his first name, how many kids he had in his family, whether he was married, the whole nine yards. Incredible man. So I went to Jimmy, and I just didn't want to go. Was there any, to the instructing job, was there any chance of staying with the squadron? Because we'd had word that there were minimum of two, at least you could do two tours back-to-back if you were in Pathfinder. So Marks said, I'll check it out. And God, he came to me and he said, yes, got authority. You can stay with the squadron and come down with us. So I was delighted. So we were then, of course, in the throes of getting ready to move. And Jimmy Marks said, well, I'll tell you what, though. I think you'd better have some leave. I mean, you're not getting any break. And you've been on operations here now pretty consistently since last November. So he said, take 3 weeks leave. You go off on leave. After we get the squadron down, we'll get settled on the base, and then you take 3 weeks leave, and that'll be it. And about that time also, we were beginning to get the first of the navigation aids. The scientists were beginning to produce,
mm-hmm.
and we got the first navigation aid, which was G, and it was like Loran, as
G-E-E,
yes, G-E-E.
What did it stand for?
I don't know. I always thought it was somebody said, gee whiz, it works. Something like that.
Electronic.
Yeah. That'd be an ABAID. You see, it's an ABAID.
Yeah.
But,
and when you say an ABAID, that means a navigation aid.
A navigation aid.
Yeah.
And a very accurate navigation aid. It was the old principle of two beacons pushing out signals, which were picked up on a scope.
Mm-hmm.
And you took the interception of the signals, and the interception was then... A reading was then put onto a chart, which had the grid lines on it, or really they were elliptical lines of transmissions from the station, and then you took a reading from the bearing, the distance from those two stations. It's simple, that distance from two stations. You plotted on this chart, this special chart, and that's where you were, and it was damned accurate.